Nolan Kaiser, interviewed November 23rd, 2010.
I'm Nolan Kaiser. I'm 76 years old. I'm now retired, but I had worked at Central Michigan University as a teacher in the philosophy department, in philosophy and religion now, for over 40 years. I'm in a rather unique position here because as a young person, a 14-year-old, I was very much interested in the sciences. All sciences, and therefore I had my own chemistry laboratory at 14 years of age. But like Alexander Pope said in his heroic couplets, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. Drink deep or taste not of that Pierian spring. And unfortunately, I did not drink as deeply as I should have. Moreover, I replicated an experiment that Thomas Edison did to warm up the school, the one-room schoolhouse, or maybe a two-room schoolhouse, mm-hmm. way back when. He had a timer, and he put some powders in there, and then had some acid at time to a 2 o'clock, that it would then tip and hit that acid would hit those powders, and it would create a virtual acetylene torch on the combustibles that he had then set up in the fireplace. Only something went and it worked fine for maybe half a year and so on, but one day he came to school and there was nothing but a smoking ruin and a frightening pall. I was doing the same thing. I simply wanted I had to burn the paper, burn newspapers and other combustibles. We lived out of town, and the upshot was that I was tired of the matches being blown out by the wind, and as a result, okay, I'm going to use these powders and so on, and put a drop of acid on it, and it would go. But I was created a bit more. I was going to create an amount that was going to store, so that I could then do that at the time I had to burn the papers. And that was where a very, very serious accident resulted. I was so badly damaged, I was both blinded, and I also lost my left hand. Mm-hmm. But I was very fortunate that I did not lose either my right hand or fingers and thumb. I had been so badly hurt by that explosion that the doctor simply said, with a great sense of sadness and real loss, that maybe to my parents, you ought to simply pray that Nolan does not make it, because it just seemed like there were such dim prospects, because I virtually had lost my face and everything, and I happened to be an athlete at that time, and so therefore I was in incredibly good shape, but. You may not have ever heard of fourth degree burns, but that simply burned right through, and therefore my organs were themselves damaged. But because of my mother and a remarkably quick thinking, I did survive.
The story that I'm getting is that as a young man, you really have, you know, these wonderful potentials. You have a mind for science, you have a natural inquisitiveness, athletic ability, and then you actually have this accident. Can you tell me how this experience has awakened you in ways that you didn't foresee?
I'm on my way, right there, you bet. Because you see, I also was a product of my society. And the society of which I was a product, among other things, was racist. Flat out. It just plain was. And at the same time, an awful lot of my friends were indeed black young men and women, but primarily men, because I had to go head to head against them in a lot of settings, and as a result and so on, it was I simply and most of my friends took a person as a person and so on, and if they were gifted and so on on the gridiron and the track and field or basketball court and so on, that was the way it was for me. Well, as a result, then, I never really distinguished and so on. Yet, I was prejudiced, but I was prejudiced against not minorities, racial minorities, not at all, but against persons who were disabled. I did not want to be tarred with the same brush that I experienced and understood that disabled people typically were this way. That is, they were tax consumers, not tax generators or workers or contributors to society. And as a result, blind people, well, they played music and they had a cup by downtown, or they would go from door to door to sell brooms. Well, I rather like the Watkins man and things of that sort. And I wanted to be, I had nothing to do with that. I did not want to be associated or even thought to be like them. As a result, and that was true even all the way through my training in philosophy.
Wow.
at the university.
Was it your study of jurisprudence and law that eventually caused this shift in your thinking
completely
about the disabled?
Yes, that's right.
And can you explain how that happened?
Yes, right. Yes, because I was up here at the university, looked at the role of the jurors and definition of jurors, fact finders here in Michigan law, and I found out that they were described as people who had to be in full possession of their natural faculties, neither infirmed nor decrepit. And at the same time, in an athletic background, and even after I was hurt, you know, throwing the shot and the discus, I did that in college too. I wait a minute, I'm not decrepit just because I can't see, because I'm blind and I only have the one hand.
So it was actually this focusing on this definition of juror. Which
that is correct.
Which felt was too narrow.
I was thrown out. Now, not because they thought me to be infirmed or decrepit, but rather because blindness itself was a reason for canceling my option to be a fact finder.
And so, learning that definition of juror was narrow and excluded you from participating in our legal machinery. I mean, what was your response to that? What did
the response was a law article that I wrote called Juries, Blindness, and the Juror Function. My real point was this. Look, instead of being blindness as being unable to see and so on, okay, there's the possibility that there is some evidence which, though admissible and so on, I could not then receive and give it a proper, balanced assessment in comparison with my fellow jurors. I made it quite clear it doesn't follow because I can't see that, therefore I cannot receive some things like even fingerprints and so on, because jurors are supposed to deliberate, that is, influence one another and exchange ideas and views and so on. Mm-hmm. And in light of that, I was apprised of that and able to then appreciate what other people were seeing here and could make up my own mind within some narrow limits. Now, not a paternity suit. I could not have in the old days without DNA, but rather looking at offspring similarity in the face, etc. No, that would be something. No, I could not do that. And I recognize that I cannot.
As I hear you, your view is that actually it could be the case that there are some cases in which we have categories of evidence that your lack of sight does actually play a role, but that's not all cases.
That that's right.
This accident that we began talking about, you went to college, you went to graduate school, you started to get into questions of what is law, and you had this direct experience in which your quote-unquote disability prevented you from participating in the judicial process, and that propelled you.
It was a major, it was a real epiphany for me. And that is when I defended my right to contribute as a fact finder, to not only be a taxpayer, but also then, and I could also be a defendant, then I should have the right also to be a fact finder upon my fellow citizens, etc. I recognize, however, if I defend myself to participate as in fullness of citizenship here, then I am defending the right of others whom I have studiously avoided associating with up to that point. Consequently, I'm wrong.
So to tie all this together, you were talking about how prior to this accident, although you eschewed any sort of racial discrimination, and perhaps because you were an athlete and you judged people based on their ability and you saw that regardless of people's skin color, etc., they could be an amazing athlete and so forth.
That's right.
But whereas when you're talking about disabled, there was this perception that you had before your accident.
By definition, disability, you know.
Right, and that they're not contributing members to society.
That's right.
I'll put it this way, in losing your sight, you're actually able to see more clearly.
Well done. That's exactly correct. That carried it off, because that's exactly what my life was really then devoted to doing, and helping others, helping myself, and in so doing, I helped others, and I said, you bet, I'll lock arms, and then we're going to go. I wouldn't have locked arms with you before, but right now I realize you are every bit the person that I am, and if there's any way I can be some assistance to you, I'm going to do it. And that's right.
Yeah. And I also want to say that there's another powerful message here, and it goes back to the power of philosophy and this idea that realizing that you're wrong. For some people, when they realize that they're wrong, they don't react in a healthy way. But in fact, your realization that you were wrong, you reacted in a very, very healthy way as
that
well.
That is right.
So the message is that... suffering a loss of actually your sight and also realizing that you're wrong could be
sort of insight that, you know what? Yes, we all gained.
Well, Dr. Kaiser, it has been an honor talking to you. And as with all of these conversations, I've learned a lot. And from you, I gained an insight that I had not previously had about the interesting role that vision plays in justice. And, of course, we do have that traditional symbol of justice as blind. Your story shows that that's not merely metaphorical, and in your life that's borne out by the work that you have done. Thank you for taking the time and sharing your story with me and everybody else.
I was honored to be able to do so. Thank you.
Thank you. Deanna Heath, interviewed November 24th, 2010.
I'm Deanna Heath. I'm 53. Right now, I'm a full-time graduate student in the MSW program at Michigan State. I'm doing an internship in the University Counseling Center at CMU, and I'm also doing some consulting with a couple nonprofits in town.
So you decided to go back to school.
Mm-hmm.
What were you doing before?
I was the executive director of a hospice program. Hospice is a program that provides physical, emotional, spiritual care to people who have 6 months or less to live. And the unit of care in hospice is not just the patient, it's the whole family. So there's a lot of caregiving, probably more so in many cases for the family than there is for the client themselves.
Mm-hmm. Did you always know you wanted to be involved in hospice? Or?
No, I had gone through a really tough time. Within a few short years, I had my stepfather was killed. I had a series of miscarriages. And then I had a daughter who died. She was a baby. And
How old was she?
She died during birth, actually.
Wow.
About 5 minutes prior to being born. Unexpected, you know, nothing was wrong, just a very weird accident. And I had a very good friend that was a terrific support person to me. And she would come every couple of days with muffins, and we'd talk, and she would just listen and listen and listen
to
me.
What was your friend's name?
Elise.
Is she still alive?
No.
Okay.
And so my daughter died in November, and then mid-January, my friend didn't show up anymore.
Elise,
yeah. And she missed a couple weeks, and so then when I called her, I found out she'd been diagnosed with lung cancer. And she was in her mid-40s. She was a runner and
was she a
vegetarian.
Smoker?
No.
Wow.
No. Very, very healthy person. And she died in May of that year. But during the last month of her life, hospice was pretty new. And so I went into the hospice office and I said to them, my friend is dying. I'm in the throes of my own grief. I have no idea what to say to her. How do I talk to her? How do I comfort her? What do I say to her husband? And the hospice director then sat with me for a long time and talked to me and gave me all the tools that I needed to walk into her house and handle whatever was going on and help her through that process.
And was that here?
Mm-hmm.
Right here in Mount Pleasant?
Yes.
And what was the hospice director's name?
Who? Mary Ellen Grenier.
Okay, Mary Ellen Grenier.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know if she's still alive?
She's not.
Okay.
No.
So you go into Mary Ellen, and so hospice was new, so did you, like, go to the phone book, or, I mean...
I stopped at the office, just...
So you knew there was something hospice, mm-hmm. You knew it had something to do with death,
mm-hmm.
And that was basically it?
That was it, yeah.
And I got to go to this place. Mm-hmm. If anybody can help me, it's them.
Mm-hmm.
And you sat down with Mary Ellen, and she gave you all of these skills. And
We probably talked for an hour.
An hour?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
But she gave me topics to talk about. She told me things not to say, which was incredibly helpful. And
What should you not say?
Things like, I know how this is for you.
Hmm.
Or, don't worry, it'll be better.
Hmm.
Or I just hope you can get through this. I hope you'll be better. To not put that stuff out there. What she told me, the main piece was, she already knows that she's not going to survive this.
Hmm.
The doctors had told her. But I've learned over the years, even when the doctor says it, you don't necessarily believe it.
Mm.
But she said she already knows these things, so don't pretend that it's not there.
Mm.
Acknowledge it and be open about it with her.
Mm-hmm.
And tell her how much she's meant to you. And tell her all the wonderful things that she's brought into your life. And thank goodness she did that, because I only had a couple more visits with her before she died. And so I feel like I said everything I had to say, and we had this wonderful exchange together on my last visit. And I've used the example many times about people, when you're a parent and you're going out for an evening and your kids are hanging on your pant leg begging you not to go. And so many people do that to the terminally ill. And how much better it is if everybody says, I don't want this, but it has to happen, and I'll be okay, and I want you to be okay, and how can I help you with that? And just giving the person who's dying a really meaningful, wonderful goodbye rather than hanging on the pant legs, pegging. Elise died in May. And
what year?
That was 1987.
Okay.
A long time ago. And so I thought after that, you know, if a job ever opens up at hospice, I'm going to apply. And the next February, one did. And I went in again and saw Mary Ellen. And she hugged me after the interview. So I thought, okay, I got a pretty good shot. So I got the job.
So how come you left that to go back to school?
The first few hospice years that I had such deep meaning for me. And the longer I was there, the bigger the organization got, the farther I got from one-on-one contact with the clients. And I missed it terribly. And although I was really, really proud of what we were able to do with Hospice House for the community, for myself personally, I lost the meaning in what I was doing because I was an administrator and I wasn't getting the time with the clients.
I see sort of like this common thread in your life where you are really captured by deep, meaningful experiences, and indeed that is how you got into hospice, and it was because your work in hospice after a while no longer gave you that you had to leave.
Exactly.
And do you think that you have now found, going back to school with an MSW, do you feel like you're coming closer to that deep, meaningful experience that you have been craving for several years?
Absolutely. My internship gives it to me. The conversations in class give that to me. Processing everything I'm learning gives that to me. I'm interning at Central's counseling services, so I'm working with students.
Okay.
And I came from a background of working with very sick, elderly people for the most part, to working with amazingly healthy teenagers and people in their 20s. Mm-hmm. And I love it. Mm-hmm. It's so interesting because their identity is just forming, and you can have a conversation with them, and you know they're listening, and they're going to take some of this forward with them. And if you can just reframe how they're thinking about something, it changes everything.
Mm. So you've really actually are having a very rich experience with helping people, because you started out helping people at the end of life, and now you're dealing with young people whose lives are in front of them. Their identities have yet to be formed. Mm-hmm. They're full of potential and possibility. And as a professor, I can tell you that that is what I find extremely gratifying. I have my students ask this question. I call it the tombstone question. And the question is, and ironically, the question comes out of a book called The Power of Story by Jim Lehrer. It's an excellent book. The question is, if you could imagine your funeral, and if you could envision it, what would it gladden you to hear people saying about you? What would you want them to say? It's always something like, she brought inspiration to people. So the correct answer is a value for someone. But you know what it is. And I think, one of the projects of identity for young people is having them reflect on how they want to be remembered. Because that gives them, sort of like the ultimate goal for which they can then judge, what I'm doing now resonating with that goal?
Mm-hmm. And that's great.
Yeah, and that's what enables you or enabled you to say, what I'm doing now, not it, so I need to go back to school. And one thing I told my students is there's two real tasks. One is answering that question, and then is finding like the right activity that allows you to express that value through action. And it could be that, like, over time, the counseling thing also becomes a bureaucracy.
absolutely could. I think the only thing I would add is with the tombstone question, so much of the hype, I guess, about my leaving hospice was about having built the hospice house.
And Woodland Hospice.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I never felt like it was my project, really, or my accomplishment, because so many people were involved. But when I think about how I want to be remembered, it's not about a community saying, we got this hospice house. It's about a person coming forward and saying, she talked to me when my dad died. Hmm. So it was about the individuals. Mm. And that's how I knew that it was important to go back to a one-on-one situation.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Well, Deanna, it has been a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thank you. It's been great.
Okay. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Same to you.
Bruce Roscoe, interviewed November 26, 2010.
Bruce Roscoe. I am the Dean of Students at Central Michigan University, which means I am the Chief Student Affairs Officer, and I oversee a number of units that work directly with students, faculty, and staff to support the students in their endeavors outside the classroom primarily.
And how long have you been in this position?
This is my 17th year.
We were talking briefly before, and you said that you see sort of both ends of the spectrum, both extremes, that you deal with intense young people who are very driven, have clear goals, know how to execute them. But on the other hand, you also see the dark side of student life.
It seems as if we have an increasing number of students that are either making bad decisions or having life experiences that cause them great stress and anxiety. And we are getting more and more involved in trying to support the students who are coming to our attention because of bad decisions or engaging in self-harm, engaging in threats of self-harm, and we spend a lot of time working with that population these days, really some troubled young people.
What sorts of bad decisions are students making today that you had not seen prior?
The bad decisions are probably the excessive alcohol drug use. Mm. For example, we had a situation the other day where two young women came in because their third roommate is a serious alcoholic. Mm. And it's to the point that her behavior is disruptive to their behavior. Mm-hmm. And they've tried all sorts of interventions and encounters with no success. Mm-hmm. But this third roommate has made so many decisions, and she really is on a path of self-destruction, we would think, based on the decisions she's made to go to class or not go to class, or have interactions, sexual encounters with individuals, and all sorts of risky type behaviors. That's the kind of student we get involved with.
And another aspect of your job is dealing with the deaths of students.
Yes. Worst part of my job, the worst part of my job, the aspect that I hate most, is dealing with the death of a student. We have students who die every year. We probably average about 12 student deaths a year. Mm-hmm. And they can be due to accidents, illnesses, or suicide. Mm-hmm. And each of them is different and unique, and yet there are commonalities in dealing with these.
What are some of the commonalities?
The commonalities are the grieving parents, the grieving roommates, the classmates, the element of not knowing how do we approach all of these audiences to lend the appropriate support. Sometimes we may err and be perceived as being too intrusive, sometimes maybe not intrusive enough, and I use intrusive carefully. You know, we try to be attentive. Sometimes it's appropriate. Sometimes people are saying, just leave us alone. But it's very, very difficult dealing with, interacting with, supporting the survivors, and then just accepting the tragedy of the death of a young person. Mm-hmm. The death of a young person is difficult because for so many people, the parents are losing so much of their future. And I'll tell you, I am amazed at these parents at the time of the loss of their child in terms of their ability to support other young people. They do a tremendous job supporting roommates, classmates, sorority sisters, fraternity brothers, and I don't know where they get the strength to care that much about others at that time when they're hurting so much. And yet they do. They're tremendous in helping these young people understand and process this death and the value of life. And I'm always amazed at how they set aside their own grief, at least for the moment, to assist these young people dealing with grief at a time when most of them don't know how to handle grief.
And so what I'm hearing you saying is that although this is the hardest part of your job, you have gained insight from it.
Oh. Well, the insight is probably an appreciation for life and an appreciation for young people. There's a tendency, I think, for folks to look at young college students and say, what a terrific time in their life. They have so much before them. Everything is wonderful. They're happy. They're carefree. Life is good. And yet, obviously for all of them, it's not. Mm-hmm. You know, for those who are suffering, for those who take their own lives, mm-hmm. it's not. I have an adolescent son, and I look at that death, and I look at him, and I think there's no guarantees. There are no assurances. Mm-hmm. You know, value and appreciate every day. Mm-hmm. So it's changed my view a little bit. It's broadened my view. Mm-hmm. I look at the student more holistically, perhaps, mm-hmm. than I did before, mm-hmm. in watching how they deal with and accept the loss of another.
And it also sounds that you have gained an insight from watching the parents.
Well, it's renewed or affirmed my faith and confidence in parents, mm-hmm. and the affection they have for their children and for young people in general, mm-hmm. Their appreciation of the lives that continue beyond mm-hmm. those of their offspring, the support, the strength that parents can bring to the surface when they see a young person in need, is mm-hmm. truly inspiring.
Mm-hmm. One possible explanation is that when something tragic happens to us, one always has a choice as to how one interprets that in one's own narrative. And it could be that these parents realize at some level that unless they do that, unless they help the roommates, that they're not really doing justice to the life of their son or daughter that they lost. And it's their way of making such a tragic event and constructing a more positive meaning around something that could go either way. Mm-hmm.
I think also there, at some level, there's a sense of how these young people process it, and if they accept it, there's a tendency that their son or daughter's death will continue to be a part of the life mm-hmm. of these other young people mm-hmm. who go on.
Also, to go back to this point that you made about your son, and what is his name?
Clinton.
And he is how old?
15.
Can you talk about how this experience of dealing with the death of students also helps you to look at Clinton in a different way?
Well, I'll tell you what I remember very vividly. My first year as dean, I became the dean in September, and we had the first student death.
And what year was it?
In 95. He died in a car accident.
Okay.
Here in Mount Pleasant. And another student was the driver of the car that killed him. Mm. And I remember the phone call in the middle of the night telling me that he died. And my wife and I immediately went and got our infant son and put him in bed with us. Mm. And just said, I need to be close. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I needed that. I don't know how to explain it exactly. I don't know that I want to think it through too much. Mm. But probably the tentativeness of our children. How long mm-hmm. do we have them? Mm-hmm. So from then on, whenever there's a student who dies, mm-hmm. I think I hold my son a little closer. Mm-hmm. Or try to, if he lets me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at 15, maybe he's... Do you think we are a culture that does not talk about death as much as we should? Because what I'm hearing you say is that actually when you realize how fragile life is, and how even no matter how young you are, you could be, yes, full of potential and possibility, but it could be taken away from you, not necessarily by your mm-hmm. own fault. You could be on the road at the wrong time. And do you think that this acknowledgement of the fragility of things would actually do us some good to come face to face with, or is that just too scary of a thing?
Well, I wish it would, and I agree with your thought. My experience has been that adolescent sense of power is such that the idea of them being vulnerable and dying or being vulnerable and injured is just so at odds with how they see themselves. What I think could be helpful is if our society had a greater or clearer sense of how do we mourn the death of a person. We don't have the rituals and the traditions that some cultures do or some religions do in responding to a loss. Mm. And so I think young people are uncertain as to what do I do now? How do I do it? Do I talk about this loss? Don't I talk about this loss? Do I mention to people that this is hurting me, or do I just take it in stride? There aren't the clear directions or the clear expectations as to how does one mourn publicly and privately. And so our young people are here walking around looking fine, but maybe carrying all kinds of grief.
I remember there was some talk about building a a monument?
Mm-hmm.
Is it,
we
is
have it,
it. We do. It's there. Where is it?
It's right across from Park Library in Central Park.
Okay.
It's a marble piece that the Student Government Association obtained funding for.
Okay.
And it's placed on campus as a place for students to mourn quietly.
Mm-hmm.
Or to gather
mm-hmm.
for a vigil when a student dies, if they so choose.
So there's something.
Oh, yes. Yes, and I was wonderful that the students initiated that.
Mm-hmm.
Just tremendous.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bruce, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Well, I've enjoyed it as well.
And happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. You too. You too.
Sally Goodrow, interviewed November 26th, 2010.
How old are you?
70.
How old are you?
77.
And Sally, what do you do?
Well, I'm a retired school social worker.
Okay. Which school?
Alma School.
And how long were you in that position?
I was in Alma about 28 years.
Okay.
And then after I retired, I worked for the Intermediate School District. I worked in all of the different schools in Gratiot and Isabella counties.
Okay. And the way that I met you was when I started to direct the Ethics Center in 2003, I went to Al Kaufman, who was the director of the United Way.
Right.
This was really the first, it was the day before or 2 days before the first Goodrow fundraiser,
mm-hmm.
the very first one. Al had two tickets. He had purchased a table,
uh-huh.
and he had two tickets, and he invited my husband and I to go to the first Goodrow benefit ball.
For heaven's sake.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that is how I heard about you and the Goodrow Fund was through Al Kaufman, and I thought that what you were doing is and continue to do is extremely important, and I was very moved by it.
Well, that's nice to hear, because Al's been in this right from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
He and my husband used to work together.
Okay. Your husband, who's no longer with us,
right?
John, how did you meet him?
Well, I was a student at Wayne State, and he had graduated from Wayne State and gone to Yale Divinity School.
Mm-hmm.
And he came back, and I met him at a luncheon at Wayne State.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we ran around in the same group of people.
Mm-hmm.
And he was taking some graduate classes, and he had two parishes he'd been ordained after he graduated from Yale. And he had a black parish and a white parish. And he used to talk about the people in the parishes and different activities and things that were going on there. And he, you know, he wanted to date, and I said, well, you know, I like you, and our dating is fine. I said, but you know, I don't like that profession you're in. This is gonna go nowhere. You know, so a couple of years later, we got married. Well, so much for that.
Why didn't you like the profession he was in?
Probably because I didn't know much about it, and I thought it would be real restricting. But you know, the more I got to know him, and the more I got to see what that profession was about. There are lots of parallels between that and social work.
Absolutely.
And so we had a lot of basic interests.
As I understand it, John acquired some sort of illness, your husband, John, when he traveled abroad. Is that correct?
Yeah. And he always wanted to go to England. And so finally he started going to England. He would go right after Easter. And so in the spring he would go out to England for a month, and he would go to Salisbury Theological Seminary. So he would go over and do research there. And the last time he went, he'd been traveling, and he was in different places. And by the time he got to Salisbury, he was sick. And he passed out when he got there, and they took him to the hospital. Well, they thought that he was having heart problems because his heart rate was irregular. So he was hospitalized there for about a week. And then it was time for him to come home. And he really couldn't walk, so he got one of the seminarians to take him to the airport and get him on a plane. And he just said, well, he'd been, had the flu or something, you know. And so they let him on the plane. And then after the plane took off, one of the stewardesses said to him, now do you want to tell me what's really going on here? And he said, I don't know. He said, I just need to get home. I picked him up in Detroit, and he was hospitalized here for 4 days.
In Mount Pleasant?
In Mount Pleasant.
Okay.
And they couldn't figure out what was wrong either. And so then, by that time, he was really getting sick. So we helicoptered him down to Ann Arbor. And they had sent the x-rays and things that they had done here. What had happened was a small intestine had ruptured, and so he couldn't. I mean, he'd lost about 40% of his body weight. He couldn't eat anything because it wouldn't go through.
Do you know how that happened?
No. That year they had different epidemics in England. And they thought that's what he had gotten. But they never did figure out. He picked up some kind of a fast-acting bacteria. And whatever that bacteria was destroyed some of his intestines.
Okay.
Caused it to rupture. Okay. And so he had surgery in Ann Arbor, but when they took the intestines out, they were so dead they couldn't get much identification from them. So they never did. Jack died in September.
What year did he die?
He died in 1985.
Okay, in 1985.
Yeah, he came home from England in May, and he died in September.
I remember reading somewhere that he would help people by taking money out of his
discretionary fund.
His discretionary funds?
Yeah.
What was the discretion? Like, what is
well,
that?
Well, every priest has a discretionary fund, and that's funded. Like, the parish will say, well, we'll give you $50 or $100 a month for your discretionary fund. Well, sometimes people will make a donation to that. And that's spent at his discretion and doesn't necessarily have to be audited by the church auditors or anything. It's just what he can
do. Right, sure.
So he started helping these people with, you know, money for groceries or utilities. And then as he got better known out in the county, there were people out there, you know, that needed wells or needed different kinds of help. So if he could do it, he'd help them or, you know, find somebody that could.
He's using this discretionary fund to help people. People start to notice.
Right.
Like, what's the time span of Father Goodrow setting up, you know, this organization, this thing that's growing?
When we moved over on Preston, and so I would set things out for dinner. And I would set out some fruit, you know, and I'd have a chicken if I had it defrosting in the refrigerator. I came home one night and I said, darn, I know I set out a can of plums for dinner. And I had this. And he came home and I said, either I'm losing my mind or somebody came in here. Oh, he says, I needed those things. He said, I had a family that needed some food. And he said, I didn't have time to run to the store. And so he said, I just grabbed a few things from here. I said, you grabbed dinner. You know, what am I supposed to do now? And so, you know, we laughed about that. And I said, well, I hope they enjoyed your dinner. And so then, and that's when he started, you know, was helping these kids at the college. So finally, some of the students at Central said, you know, we need to pay back. So they started having food drives. Well, gee, you know, what are we going to do with all this stuff? So in the basement of the old rectory there, it's a Michigan cellar, but it's dry and it's warm. So we had canned goods and boxed cereal and stuff.
So you moved here in 62, and John died in what year?
85.
Okay. And so by that time, there was a full-blown operation going.
Yeah.
It's my understanding that you, recognizing how powerful this organization that he had set up, you had the presence of mind to preserve that.
Because while he was sick, you know, I said to him, I said, what's going to happen to the food program? He called it the emergency program.
That's what he called it.
Yeah. And so he said, well, I'll be up to the vestry.
So did he call it the emergency fund and everybody else called it the food program?
Yeah.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. What's the vestry?
The vestry is the governing body of the church.
Okay.
And they pay the bills. The priest never has anything to do with them.
Sort of like the board of trustees.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they run the show.
Mm-hmm.
So after he died, I said to the vestry, what are you going to do with the food program? What are your plans for this? So they said they were going to close it down.
Why did the church want you out?
Because they didn't want to deal with it.
Right.
It was a lot of work. The vestry just had their hands full with other issues.
Okay.
They had to call a priest. They had to deal, the bishop said they had to deal for 2 years with interim priests. They had to deal with the grief of the parish. They just didn't have the skills and they didn't have the interest to keep it up. So I said, okay. I said, how about if I try to take it over? And I got calls from people in the community who had ways and means of dealing with things. Well, I mean, I was dealing with my own grief. And so I had a meeting at my house, and I said, I know we shouldn't let this program go, but how are we going to keep it going? There was probably 8 or 10 of us. And I said, you know, I could see how we could make it go if we used volunteers. And somewhere along the line, after John died, somebody gave us an old lumberyard on Maple Street, just down from the church.
Anonymously, or?
Yeah, well, sort of. They wanted to get rid of it. That's why they gave it to
us. Okay, I see.
Yeah, but at least there was a part of the lumberyard. I mean, it was a godforsaken place. But there was a room in there that we could clean out and set up shop because the church wanted us out. We were done.
You're banished to the lumberyard.
Yeah, and I mean, it was banished. And so we...
That's incredible.
Yeah. We had this one big room, and so we could work out of that. And somebody got us a car that we could use to get things from one place to another. But the support continued from the community, not necessarily from the church. I mean, people in the church gave, but the community did. And so finally we decided that we would try to get people to work with volunteers. You know, and I said, if we could do it with volunteers and have 2 on a week, they could screen things. So then we were in business. So, because I was a social worker, I did some training. We got 10 or 12 women and men together. And some of them are still working.
Father Goodrow dies. You get banished to this lumberyard.
Right. Yeah. We were down there almost 2 years.
For 2 years. And still you're getting help from the community.
Right.
Cars and volunteers and money and so forth. And this grew into an entity that continues to grow.
Right.
It continues to evolve. Now you do, and this is how I learned about it, from Al Kaufman, I told you at the beginning, because it was the very first year, which I believe was at 2003,
right,
that you had the first benefit ball. Yeah.
See, we set up a board of directors during that 2 years.
Yeah. During what 2 years? When you were in the lumber yard?
Yeah.
Okay.
We set up a board of directors. In 2003, you know, I had met Pat Hathaway. I said, you know, the one thing we really need to do is an annual fundraiser. And I kept saying that to the board, but nobody on the board really wanted to bite on that one. And I didn't feel like I had the expertise. She said, Jim and I could do that. We know how to do that. We've done it at St. Henry's. So that 2003 was the first one. And so in October, she and I went in to see Al Kaufman. And we said, well, we want to have a fundraiser in January. He said, he just laughed. He said, you to our Christ. And I said, yeah, that's doable. He said, not in this world. And I said, why not? And he said, do you know how long it takes to plan this thing? And entertainment? And I said, got nothing to do but do it.
That was a great fundraiser. I was,
yeah.
It's a total, so, you had a one-man.
Yeah, we had this one-man band. And, you know, and we were out at the country club.
Yep.
So he said, have at it, ladies. But he said, you'll never get it together. So I said, sure we will. And Pat said, I can do this. Huh. So she and I worked on it. Huh. And, you know, we went out and got the country club. She got this one-man band. So then we decided we'd have a silent auction. You know, I made some quilts.
And I think there was like Miss Michigan or some beauty queen.
We got anybody and everybody. We just said, come on. And we put this thing together, you know. And I thought, oh, my God, we're probably going to be the laughingstock of the community. But it worked.
It did. It worked so well that, you know, we came back. So I want you to speak about how your presence of mind to say, look, we need to keep this going. The vestry says we can't do it, but through grace, it happens. I want you to talk about how that preserves the memory and it keeps a dialogue going about Father Goodrow.
You know, while he was sick, John Hahn and I had talked, and I thought, you know, if he did anything that was really worth anything, this is it. So I thought, you know, maybe this is kind of a ministry of sorts of its own. Mm. And people that became volunteers felt that way too.
I don't know if you're familiar with the distinctions between a will and a trust.
Right.
Right? Yep. And it's almost like this is a trust, his own trust fund that he did not plan it to be a trust fund, but through your action and fortuity in the community, it is now a self-standing 501c3, and it will continue to grow. Going back to the beginning of the conversation, when you say you first met Father Goodrow, and you say, you know, you're just really not interested in him because his line of work just doesn't appeal to you, but then you come to realize that there are these common threads in both of your work, and one is really helping people.
Right.
And I just want to say that from my point of view, where I'm sitting now hearing this story, it seems to me that because that's was part of his core and it's also part of your core, you said to yourself after he died, you looked at it like, what is the way that he really helped people? Because that's really who he wanted to be. He wanted to be that individual. And you saw this organization as a manifestation of him. Mm-hmm. And it was because you're also built of that same core, the same moral fiber, that you're able to see that and preserve his memory in a way that will continue to influence generations after I'm gone, I'm sure.
Well, I hope.
And so I just want to thank you for your insight and your drive. And when many people had the vestry said, no, you know, we don't want to deal with it, a lot of people would have said, oh, well. But you feel compelled to preserve this.
Yeah, you know, and I think, you know, through prayer and meditation, and you know, I talked to different clergy, and it just seemed like that was the thing to do.
Right.
And once I accepted that, once I made that decision, then it was easy.
Sure.
Because then I found I had a lot of support, and not only from people in the church, but in the community. Mm. And it's always been that way.
I want to close with actually one of my favorite quotes, and it's from W.H. Murray, who was a mountain climber and an environmentalist. And this is the abridged version of the quote. But going back to what you just said about, you know, making the decision was the hard part, but once you made that decision, all of this help came. And the quote is, the moment that one commits oneself, then providence moves too. And he goes on to explain that once you actually make a decision and commit to something, that people and forces and things that you could have never predicted come out and help you. And it goes back to what we were saying before. And I think part of the explanation for that is that act of that decisiveness, saying, I'm going to do this, that is the hard part. And once people see you doing that hard part, that makes it easy for everybody else.
Right.
So on that, I want to thank you, Sally Goodrow, for sharing your story with me and everybody else. It's been a pleasure, and I'm so grateful to have met you and to have run into Al Kaufman in 2003 and be exposed to Good Row when they started the annual ball.
Right.
And the annual ball is again happening in January of this year.
Right, January 21st.
And it just keeps getting bigger and better.
That's it. And so, we hope to see you there.
Absolutely.
And I really appreciate all your help, because you've helped us a great deal.
Thank you. It's my pleasure and
appreciate
honor.
Appreciate your coming here.
Thank you, and happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks. Same to you.
Jeffrey Wigand, interviewed November 27th, 2010.
We're sitting here today. It's November 28th, 2010, 2 days after the National Day of Listening. And I'm sitting with the love of my life, my beloved husband, Jeffrey Wigand. Jeff, thanks for sitting down with me on this lazy Sunday.
I am engrossed in one of my favorite activities, reading the New York Times, which is something I do every Sunday, and it's delivered to me promptly in the morning by my lovely wife.
Which, I just interrupted you from this sacred Sunday activity.
So I have two more sections to read through.
Okay, we can talk about all of that later. How old are you, Jeff?
I am 68 years old.
And most people know of you through the amazing work that you did as a man of conscience, making people aware of the truth about the tobacco industry, documented in the incredibly moving film, The Insider. But I don't want to talk about that, because that's out there and people know about that. And having been with you for going on 11 years now, there's a story that I would like for you to talk about, and it goes back to your childhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I grew up, I'm the oldest of five, born and raised in the Bronx. As I was growing up, I was of slight stature. I went to private schools. We all did. My parents were adamant that we all got good grades and we all went to good schools. And so we went to parochial schools, all of us. But what you're referring to is that as somebody who was small, I used to get picked on a lot. And when I got picked on, I used to come home with a bloody nose or scraped knees or whatever. And rather than getting my father's and mother's sympathy, I was told that I was supposed to pull my bootstraps up and deal with it, particularly people who were bigger than I were and bullied me.
So you would come home with a bloody nose, black eye, very, very upset, obviously, hoping to get some nurturing from your parents, and instead your father, being quite the taskmaster, would say, "Son, we're going to deal with it."
Yep. And the way we dealt with it was we got down in the backyard. My father knew at that time, a heavyweight prize fighter by the name of Paddy Young. He was a boxer.
How do you spell Paddy?
P-A-D-D-Y. And Desmond Costello. And they proceeded to give me...
Paddy and Desmond.
Paddy, Desmond, my father, stood and made sure I got boxing lessons. And I was to learn how to defend myself. I was no longer to be a wimp in the street.
So your father knew Paddy Young.
Mm-hmm.
And Paddy Young was a prize fighter.
Heavyweight prize fighter, yes.
And who was Desmond Costello?
Desmond was a close friend of my father's or worked out at the gym. I mean, he was once upon a time a boxer of sort. But Paddy Young was quite the impressive prize fighter. I mean, his hand was the size of a toilet seat, and his nose was spread from ear to ear, and you can tell that he had been in the ring many, many times. And he proceeded to teach me how to box.
Where would he teach you? This is in your backyard?
In the backyard.
At your home?
At a home, yes.
So you basically had these prize fighters making house calls.
Yeah, well, sort of house calls, yeah. Made house calls, and it was sometimes around my schedule, my dad's schedule. Because at that time, my dad was not only working, but also going to NYU to become an engineer.
And when they would come to your house to teach you how to box, these prize fighters, and how old were you at the time?
I was at elementary school at the time.
Eight, nine, ten, eleven.
I can't remember exactly, but it was a long time ago.
Okay. So they would come over to your house, Paddy, Desmond, sometimes by themselves, sometimes together, I would imagine.
And then I went, time to time, on Saturday, I would go downtown to the gym, Stillman's Gym.
Okay, but when they would come to your house, would they bring anything?
First of all, they brought boxing gloves and some of the boxing equipment that you would punch at or hit at, which were gloves that were worn on the instructor's hands. And they started out with the basics of how to stand, how to put your weight behind a punch, and where to hit somebody when you wanted to inflict as much amount of pain as you wanted to inflict on somebody. But the whole intent of all these lessons is that my father was no longer willing to tolerate me coming home beat up. All I can remember, thinking back, is how big these gloves were. And how small I was.
These were not gloves made for children specifically.
No, these were gloves that Paddy brought or Desmond brought. I'm not quite sure who did it.
Come once a week? Or
say, best of my memory, maybe once a week.
Once a week? Okay.
Maybe twice a week.
For how long did this training go on?
I think for months.
Months.
Until I'd learned the art.
And so then you had been bullied, and then were you given an opportunity to practice this art?
Well, the fellow that bullied me got a very big surprise one day.
What was his name?
Tommy Schapter, who was much larger than I was. And when Tommy was doing what he always had done to me,
on the way home
from school, he would push me around, knock my books out, kick your foot behind you so you sort of trip or hit the back of your head, or just the taunting that goes on with bullying. I now turned around and I was able to deliver to him what was a surprise. Was several blows that basically brought him down to his knees, and I left him with a bloody nose, and I walked away. I was taught, the best thing to do, though, was to avoid a fight, is to retreat, but in this case, I administered what I thought was the appropriate response to somebody who had bullied me for many, many, many years, many, many times.
This early on experience of the skill in fighting and standing up for yourself played a huge role. I mean, that what you did with the tobacco industry arose out of that. Do you share that interpretation? Do you think that I'm reaching?
I think my parents, particularly my father, was a very strict martinet in many ways, but instilled in us lots of what I would say core values. Like honestly, we would get more in trouble for lying than for the act if we got caught. things like that. The focus on education and achieving more than they had was very important to them.
Sure,
my parents.
And undoubtedly your education brought you into your work as head of research and development. But the thing that you did which amazes people, inspires people, moves people to tears, it's a David and Goliath story. Your education got you there, but I don't think biochemistry, for instance, gave you the moral fiber and the strength to stand up against the tobacco industry. For me, I trace it back to those days in the alleyway with Patty Young and Desmond Costello. What I'm hearing you say is it was not just that, it's a combination of that in addition to the installation of these core values, including a value for education. And today, you still do a lot with the tobacco industry in terms of speaking not only to young persons at all levels, including children, to professional students, to policymakers, mental health professionals. I mean,
doctors, lawyers.
Yeah, I mean, you speak to everybody. So you're still very much involved with the tobacco piece of your life, but there's a new chapter. You moved to Mount Pleasant in 2003.
Mm-hmm. August.
In August 2003. Several years thereafter, you ran for and was elected to a seat on the Mount Pleasant Board of Education.
That's correct. Well, my interest was in running for is to probably give something back to the community and trying to help the students that go through the system to come out with a better education so that they're more so. They can do things that are more socially relevant in their life, go on to college and do bigger and better things. And I felt that the way they were getting educated was their interests were not best at heart, taken to heart. And they weren't the first priority. And that came after seeing students in the universities and their lack of core competencies, that maybe one way to influence it would be through a board of education.
And I should say that you have a master's in the art of teaching.
Yes.
That after you earned a PhD in biochemistry, you did go back to school and became a master teacher. And so this interest in teaching is not just some spontaneous interest that you gained from moving to Mount Pleasant. And I also want to trace it back to, going back to your father, these core values that were instilled, the ability to stand up for yourself and fight, these core values like honesty and so forth, and also the value of education.
Education was very important to my family.
Right. And I see that lesson being carried out now through your serving on the Mount Pleasant Board of Education. As you're a trustee of the Mount Pleasant education system, one thing that I've witnessed is you working with community members.
Yes. Part of the education of the children that are in the school system comes from the community. And the school education system is to serve the community by helping to produce educated children. And I have worked extensively since been elected with the community, empowering the community to speak up when they don't see what's going on in the school, that fortifies the education process of their children.
When you're talking about community, it's not this amorphous group of people. It's actually specific individuals who have children in the system that have come to you with concerns, and you actually invite them to our home, and you sit down and
help them on this. They didn't know how to get their voice. They were afraid to come. They would talk to me on the condition of anonymity, and they wouldn't come in front of the board and raise the issue because they were either shy or felt that they weren't going to be taken seriously. And so I invited people who constantly contacted me, both in the community as parents, but also teachers and administrators. So I've helped people make presentations. I've helped people organize thoughts. I've taught people how to stand up and speak their piece And in a process, things are starting to slowly change.
I would like to shift gears. I wasn't planning on talking about this, but since we're talking about the value of education and the role that you play in empowering people to stand up for themselves, and how it is at least plausible to trace that strength of yours to this early experience with Patty Young and Desmond Costello. I know that you had a student when you became a teacher at DuPont Manuel named Sarah Mudd. Can you talk about Sarah?
That's hard. I taught at Manuel biology, chemistry, physics, mathematics, and Japanese. Sarah Mudd was a beautiful little girl. Who had cerebral palsy. And because she had cerebral palsy, in science classes, nobody ever forced her in a way to become independent. And Sarah used to come to class always with her dog, a golden retriever.
Do you remember the name?
I used to call him Fleabag. But what I taught Sarah, and now Sarah's in law school, was that she could do a laboratory experiment because I teamed her up with another student. She also could get up in front of class and do a research paper. And I have to say it had remarkable results. I mean, this is somebody who had always been coddled and sort of put aside and not mainstreamed in general education, but special education. And I just mainstreamed her 100%.
So you actually made her give a class presentation.
Yeah, I made her do a research. Part of her grade was getting up in front of the class and actually using some form of audiovisual technology.
Could she stand?
No, she could not stand. She was confined to an electric wheelchair.
So in her presentation, she wheeled herself up to the front of the classroom?
She could wheel. She had a little joystick that she could wheel up. She dressed for the occasion. I mean, she got all dressed up. Fleabag wasn't there.
Why not?
I don't know. Because when she came to my class, she knew that she had to do it on her own. And she would get help from one of her students. I assigned a student to help her with some tasks like that she couldn't do by herself, like in the laboratory, you know, mixing chemicals, so that she would actually have the true experience of being involved in biology and being involved in chemistry and understand the beauty of the science. And so she just flourished. She bloomed. At the end of it, she said she wanted to go to law school. And she said at the end of it, "Well, I know I'm going to disappoint you, Dr. Wygand, but I'm not going to become a chemist. I'm going to become a lawyer," which was just great news to me, because that was her doing something with her life, even though she was severely handicapped. I still am in contact with her today, and her parents are forever thankful to me for making her do things that she had never done before.
And what year was it that you had her as a student?
I think I had her as a student in 1996 when I was National Teacher of the Year.
So 14 years ago.
Yeah, 14 years ago.
And if I may speculate.
Speculate, okay.
Going back to this formative experience with you and Patty Young and Desmond and your father. And as you said, as a child, you were slightly built. You're not hulkish by any means. This lesson that your father taught you through working with Patty and Desmond also played a role in you with Sarah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was an enabler. Mm-hmm. I helped Sarah become more than what people were going to let her be.
And going back to, you said at one point, I think your grandmother would have coddled you. You know, had you come home with a bloody nose and so forth, where your father said, no, yeah, we're going to teach you how to defend yourself. And what I'm getting from your story is actually like coddling. Maybe there's a time and a place for it, but sometimes that actually is a debilitating response.
I have to give my father credit for recognizing that I needed to get some way to retaliate. I guess he would much rather me come home and getting a bloody nose from defending myself rather than becoming a coward, so to speak, and getting beat up. I did grow up in a rather rough and tumble environment, but my father sought to give me the tools to be able to be autonomous in that environment.
Mm-hmm. And likewise, you gave similar tools to Sarah to be autonomous. Well, Jeffrey.
Can you get back to my paper now?
I just want to say that I've learned so much from you. Before I met you, I had learned so much. Then you came into my life, and I continue to learn and grow and benefit from you. And you're the love of my life.
I think you said that already. You're becoming redundant.
And I just want to thank you for everything that you
I'll
do.
I'll edit that out.
I want to thank you for everything that you do for people who are fortunate enough to be in your presence, because what I see from where I sit is you actually have the best interests of every person at heart when they come to you. And there are different ways of helping people, some coddling, some making them, forcing them to do what they may find difficult. But in the end, as your experience shows you, and as the experience of Sarah Mudd illustrates, that is what people need actually to become autonomous and free.
No, certainly.
I thank you for your work and doing that for all of us.
Well, I'm not done yet.
Good.
Many, many more years to go.
Good. And happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving. Great Thanksgiving.